But first, let's go on a tour of the former Soviet blocs and reconsider the architecture of communism. Now turn the sound up because we're introducing it with a piece of music to get your blood pumping. When I was a young communist wandering around the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, I was always astonished by the magnitude, the hubris, the preposterous arrogance of what would always be a centerpiece, whether you were in Poland or Moscow itself. There would be a vast Stalin edifice, often called the House of Culture. Ridiculous, preposterous, crazy buildings, which the locals had an ironic attitude to. I remember the Poles would look at their example and mumble, "Tiny but exquisite." Now, the fact is that there's much more to Soviet architecture than that, from palatial underground railways to vast housing estates. The architecture of communism was, of course, an expression of power and an attempt at state-driven social engineering. But to a lot of critics, Marxist-inspired buildings are replete with quirks and contradictions, and many of these structures, like the aforementioned Stalinist houses of culture, hodgepodge of designs, jumbled features lifted from movements as varied as brutalism to neoclassicism. Now, to guide us through this complicated world, let's talk to a bloke who knows it very, very well. Owen Hatherley is an author and journalist with The Guardian, and his latest is Landscapes of Communism, A History Through Buildings. And while living and travelling throughout Eastern Europe, Owen was busy examining the many distinctive urban spaces that a profit-driven society might not have been able to make. And I welcome him to our little program, LNL, which tonight is most emphatically LNL. Owen, you've spent years drifting through the cities of former communist countries, analysing how the values of Marxism, or more specifically Stalinism, are reflected in their buildings. What did communist architects do that was so different to capitalist architects?
Well, they had a degree of a sort of weird combination of carte blanche and very, very explicit commands. So you could have a sort of expanse of space and an opulence of materials and a sort of absurd kind of grandiosity of scale combined with a client that was very, very sure about what it wanted. So they had this sort of strange combination of extreme freedom and extreme unfreedom. And I think the results are that they go for various kind of fashions and styles generally share this as a problem.
There was a lot of Italian influence, oddly enough, in the era of Kremlin building, but you describe Vienna as the unacknowledged father of communist architecture.
That's largely because of the way that Vienna was rebuilt in the 19th century, when you have the Ringstrasse and so forth, and you have this incredibly opulent facades on very wide streets, and then behind that you've got lots of very grubby courtyards that you're not really supposed to look at, and the flats get kind of gradually worse as you go further into those courtyards. The Viennese architect Adolf Loos called Vienna a Potemkin city, which is kind of apt given Potemkin villages being a Russian thing. And I think later the Potemkin cities became very much a Soviet thing.
It's interesting that when I first started going to the Soviet, I couldn't understand the breadth of the roads, given that there wasn't a huge amount of traffic.
That's because they're not for driving in, they were for parades. And that's, initially this kind of idea that there would be, kind of self-organized parades, and then very, very quickly parades which you had to go to every May Day and every October. And that's what it's for. It's for that display of crowds sweeping through the street.
What did Marx and Engels have to say about architecture, do you know?
Very, very little. It's kind of ironic given that, so much of the what Stalinist regimes did was this kind of Parisian Viennese boulevard thing, that Marx only really remarks about architecture when he's denouncing Haussmann, who he credits with destroying historic Paris and replacing it with the Paris of the sightseer. And Engels writes a little bit about philanthropic housing schemes, which he's equally kind of dismissive of. And that's the lot.
But you do report on something which I'd completely forgotten from my Bolshevik youth, that Marx and Engels did argue in the manifesto that communism should obliterate the division between city and country. And yep. You talk about a Trotskyite who imagines the future socialist metropolis as something resembling Los Angeles.
Mikhail Okitovich, yeah. He died in the Gulag, which I think is a...
another great architectural achievement of the Stalinist era.
But there is a sense in which they kind of fulfilled some of those ideas a little bit under Khrushchev. Under Khrushchev, there was a great encouragement of dacha colonies, and you've got these very cheap kind of prefab kits that you could build dachas out of. And so you have, you know, between the big cities, you do have this thing that's not really city and that's not really country, and the dacha colonies are it. So they kind of got round to it in some respects.
Is there one authentic architecture of communism, or just lots of different styles?
Absolutely not. There's not an authentic one at all. I think it's a massively subjective thing. It's also depends on your definition of communism, which I spent the most of the introduction trying to come to, and don't.
The great space, or the great architectural statement in Moscow that most enthralled me on my first trips was, of course, the metro, the underground mm-hmm. railway stations, which were and are astonishing. They have the same theatricality as the great cinemas of the era, you know, that came out of the Dream Factory of Hollywood. You're quite taken with those as well, aren't you?
They're mind-boggling. They're incredible spaces. I mean, the way in which they were constructed was brutal in the extreme, at least up until the 1950s. But the, the sheer kind of size of them, the opulence and generosity of space, the way that they often tell stories, narratives. You know, they're sort of have kind of ideas within them. And also the fact, which I think has been very neglected, is that it didn't stop in Moscow in the 50s, that the metro stations in other cities, such as St. Petersburg and Kiev, later outside the Soviet Union in Prague, even up to the 80s in smaller cities like Nizhny Novgorod, the standard is incredibly high. And they could keep doing this. And in some cities, I mean, Moscow and Kiev being examples, you know, even recent stations are quite similar to the kind of scale and drama of that era. And it's very well established. And I think that's quite interesting.
Of course, around the world, above ground railway stations could be astonishing, as the game of Monopoly, for example, or its English version reminds us. I can't think of a metro system anywhere else apart from Russia where any effort has been made to beautify them.
Well, apart from Russia and, Prague and Bucharest and Ukraine and so forth. But, yeah.
I meant in the Western world.
Yeah. There's one or two that kind of come to mind. Stockholm is very good, but mostly that sense of scale is and that sense of drama and beauty is completely unique to the former Soviet Union and its satellites, underground at least.
When people think of Stalinist architecture, they do think there is one authentic architecture of communism, and they imagine concrete, bland, domineering structures made pretty much in the brutalist style. But you say that while Stalin might have been brutal, the buildings were often not.
They weren't brutalist, put it that way. They weren't modernist of any kind. After the kind of early 30s, when Stalin really kind of asserts his power, architecture goes through this kind of weird period of sort of imperial neo-baroque, very, very heavily decorative, very historicist. I mean, one of the few times that you can like pinpoint Stalin having a direct influence on architecture is when 7 skyscrapers were commissioned in Moscow just after the war. And he looked at various of the designs and said, there's not a spire here. There needs to be a spire. And so they all have these kind of Kremlin-style spires stuck on top. In some cases, you know, quite clearly disrupting the design. In other cases, more integrated. But they're very, very of a piece with Moscow's historical architecture, not in terms of scale, but in terms of the architectural language. You know, they look like giant Kremlins, essentially.
I'm talking to Owen Hatherling from The Guardian, whose new book is The Landscapes of Communism, A History Through Buildings. And you've actually had the audacity, and this will get you sent to the Tower, you've had the audacity to compare Stalin's architectural conservatism to that of Prince Charles.
Well, they're not massively dissimilar. It's much, I think, what the prince would like in architecture is not necessarily what Stalin liked in architecture, but what they disliked was much the same. And the language with which they, with which it was criticized was incredibly similar. When Stalin basically, in the 1930s, you know, decrees modernism out of existence, because before that, the Soviet Union were one of the centers of modern architecture, it's because it's inhuman, it's just boxes, all these flat roofs, all this glass, it's got nothing to do with the historical city, it's not beautiful. It's very, very, very familiar stuff. You can imagine, you know, Stalin talking about monstrous carbuncles or what have you.
Now, of course, Hitler had a very favourite architect who they worked hand in hand to contemplate this Germany of the future. Did Stalin have a favourite or favourites?
There's not really any Stalinist spear. And as I said, it's very hard to find direct examples of Stalin's involvement. Those spires are quite rare. Because Hitler fancied himself as a bit of an architect, and Hitler had very specific tastes, which were a kind of middle-class good taste. He liked neoclassicism, what in, you know, Anglophone countries would be considered neo-Georgian. That's what Hitler was into, just on a much bigger scale. And with Stalin, the architecture is much more bizarre. It's much more kind of irrational and strange.
Let's go back briefly to the metro, and I'm going to read something you wrote here. It's more than simply an emblem of power control. The metro gives something back to the people, providing craft, beauty, opulence and grandeur. And I find this a fascinating little tidbit. More marble went into the stations of the first line than into all the palaces of the Tsar in the 50 years before the revolution.
Yep, and that was they used to kind of hold up statistics like that in propaganda as a way of kind of going, look how great we are. I mean, it was almost a kind of potlatch. You know, a sort of extreme generosity, as if, you know, to kind of make a particular point of kind of like, you know, this is proof that we are arriving at communism. Every day on your way to work, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are living in palaces. Of course, the places they were actually living day to day were not palaces.
Now, the sight of those drab, featureless concrete housing projects in Russia and across the former bloc might be enough to turn people away from communism, but as you correctly argue, these housing estates were actually an example of one of the Soviets' more humane policies.
Absolutely, and also very much something that came from Western influence, which is something that people like to forget. You know, under Khrushchev, these kind of expensive, over-the-top building projects that Stalin favoured, like these skyscrapers and like the most opulent of the metro stations, were rejected in favour of building lots of decent housing quickly, because, of course, there was a terrible disaster in housing after the war. Millions of people had been made homeless. And the place where they went to find, you know, examples of how to do this was France. They basically imported the Carmeau system, a French concrete construction system, and then did that. And they did that in a much greater scale than France did, but then they had a much greater problem to solve.
Is it true that communist architecture is being rediscovered by a new generation?
It varies from country to country, but in certain places, absolutely. I mean, Poland is a major example of that. You know, the architecture of that era is extremely fashionable there now. You know, if I say this to people over a certain age, they usually think I'm making it up. But the Palace of Culture in Warsaw is very, very popular among young people. I was there less than a fortnight ago.
That's the one I described as this tiny but exquisite, and it's now popular.
And this, you know, this bizarre kind of, you know, sort of Empire State Building imposed on what was then an entirely low-rise city, with a gigantic square in front of it. You know, if you go there on an evening in summer, that square is full of
tables and chairs and fashionable young people drinking expensive and fashionable drinks. And they're very, it's been very much claimed by younger people. And I think that that kind of assumption that everybody hates this stuff is rather dubious.
Many of the communist structures are now adorned with advertising billboards, and in a rather symbolic occasion, a few years back, a McDonald's opened up next to Checkpoint Charlie. But I learned from your book that Nikita Khrushchev actually had ideological admiration for the McDonald's hamburger.
For fast food in general, yeah. Proletarian food, quick, fast, industrial. It's all very Soviet, and completely the same anywhere you are. It's very much a Soviet idea.